Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversation Season 7. Before we begin, of course, we must not forget that we are living and working on Shkrempikulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkrempik people. And it's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we're delighted to welcome a guest who has close to a half century of experience in food and food systems. Dr. Kent Mullenix is the director of the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems, located at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. But as you will hear today, he is far more than an academic professor. He is a passionate and articulate and well-seasoned advocate of growing food sustainably, and even in many respects a personification of the adage, think globally and act locally. So Kent, allow me to extend you a very warm welcome to Food Conversations.
Well, thank you, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here and join you.
I've waited a long time to have an opportunity to connect with you. I remember back in, it was 2012, our benighted provincial government of the day had set up a committee. It was called the Special Committee on Cosmetic Pesticides. And it was around the time that I'd realized you had moved to Canada because of, and were involved in sort of the IPM, the Integrated Pest Management process, which at that time was being actively co-opted by the pesticide industry. And I remember when the report came out, and I think both of us were keenly aware of this travesty. It said, the committee concluded that there is insufficient scientific evidence to support a province-wide ban on pesticides for cosmetic use. And I thought, oh, dear, dear, dear. Oh, dear, 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 what are we doing? Now, that at that time, you'd come to Canada on a permanent basis, but you'd also, that was in 2007, but long before that, a decade before that, you'd already dipped your toe in the water of Canadian territory and activities. You came in 1997 and started what was going to be a major project. Why don't you describe that project and your link to UBC?
Sure, Warren. Well, I had been in academia for 20 plus years, working in agriculture, and I'm a pomologist by training. Tree fruit production is my specialty. Apples, pears, and cherries.
That's right.
Yeah,
I was going to explain that, but you went right in and did it.
Yeah. So, and I lived in Eastern Washington and worked in the apple industry in Eastern Washington, teaching and doing research and overseeing an academic program. And I spent a lot of time in the Canadian Okanagan, and I can recollect my family and I driving, family and me driving across the border, and kind of go, "Wow, this is the America we wish we lived in."
Canadian listeners, thank you. thank you at this moment.
it was a tangible difference. Mm. And so we really just fell in love with Canada. Mm. And then over time, I had the opportunity to pursue, to take a sabbatical. And I have a PhD from the University of Missouri in ag education. Mm-hmm. And in academia and working in the sciences, that's not enough. And it wasn't enough to advance the ideas that I wanted to advance about sustainability in agriculture production systems, eschewing pesticides, dependence on pesticides, and embracing a deeply ecologically sound agriculture. And so I went to UBC to pursue a PhD in plant science specializing in pest management of tree fruit. Mm-hmm. and to begin a research project for that degree to investigate what would happen in an orchard in the arid Northwest, Wenatchee, the Okanagan, if we eschewed pesticides. And I wanted to see what would happen. And the hypothesis was that in the arid Northwest, because of the uniqueness of our climate and the pest dynamics, that indeed you could, and the emergence of new biologically based pest management tools like viruses that are unique only to arthropods, affect only arthropods, that you could successfully and economically cultivate apple without any pesticides.
And our listeners would like to know one thing. Did it work?
It did work. It absolutely worked. So I conducted an experiment over four growing seasons, a 7-acre experiment, replicated and soundly designed, and demonstrated that apples could be grown in the arid Northwest, eschewing all synthetic pesticides. And what was just so interesting is all of the pests, except for one, all of the pests that we applied pesticides for became non-pests. Biological control agents controlled their populations to non-pestiferous levels. The only arthropod that was continued substantially economically damaging the crop was the codling moth, which is the worm in the apple. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the reason why it did is because it's an exotic pest.
Oh yeah,
and there are no natural enemies for it. So, but we did successfully manage it, not control it, manage it, mm-hmm. and curtail economic damage through sanitation, through the utilization of mating disruption techniques, mm-hmm. inundating the orchard with
pheromones.
Coddling moth pheromone, mm-hmm. and applying a pathogen, a virus.
You know, it's interesting because a decade later, I mean, this was a 5-year project, a big project, and mm-hmm. obviously it worked because they gave you your PhD, but at the same time, obviously there was a certain amount of turmoil going on just in terms of bringing sustainability principles to bear, mm-hmm. on the one hand, but also in your work, you were firmly embedded in the University, Washington State University's pantheon. You were an mm-hmm. endowed professor in the field of pomology, mm-hmm. and as sustainability became a theme in your thinking and your work, you were surrounded by a kind of a different mindset and a different approach. The world of politics was starting to play into what you were doing. Let's talk a little bit about that, because it's not an easy decision to leave a quarter century long career and, you know, migrate to another country unless there's something really at stake. And why don't you just paint that scene a little bit for listeners?
Sure, Warren. It is true that as I learned about the impacts of agriculture on our ecosystem, on rural communities, on human health, on everything's health, and generally came to understand the diverse adverse impacts of industrial agriculture methodology, I began embracing the constructs of a deeply sustainable agriculture. Mm. and food system, including organic production. And I started teaching this and helping the students understand the why and the how of ecologically sound agriculture, and converted the 40-acre teaching and research orchard that we used as the basis for teaching students
sort of hands-on stuff.
To organic production and long story short, the industry didn't fully appreciate that shift.
A major
and it became very difficult.
I can imagine. A major player at that time was Earl Butz. I in my notes I called him the infamous Earl Butz because he actually resigned after he made some horrible remarks about Black Americans. But he was the Secretary of Agriculture in the 70s when you were finishing your first degree and your second. And his mantra, I found this out when I was looking the gentleman up, was get big or get out.
That's
and
right.
he was the leading figure in a number of Republican regimes that brought in the notion that agribusiness was better than the family farm and was sort of overseeing this process. Just remind listeners, by the way, that I'm speaking with Kent Mullenix, Dr. Kent Mullenix, who's the director of the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Now, Kent, while you were becoming immersed and attached to the notion of sustainability and an awareness of what, as you said, we're doing to the planet that we live on, our planetary home, what was the world around you, the world of academe and the world of politics and the sort of social pattern, what was that doing and how did that play into your eventual major step of letting go of an established career and moving north?
Yeah. Well, certainly, I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture in 1976, and that was right at the beginning of the industrialization, globalization of our agriculture and food system. And, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a real debate on how to approach agriculture and food systems. There was a movement called Low Input Sustainable Agriculture, or LISA. And in fact, the University of Missouri was an epicenter of that kind of debate, because Missouri, my home state, had more family farmers in it than any state of the union other than Texas. So it was, and it's a major agriculture state, right, but smaller family farms.
And Texas cheats by having a heck of a lot land area.
It's huge, second only to Alaska in land base. And so the debate was LISA versus technology and industrialization. And we all know what won out. It was not LISA. It was industrialization and globalization.
Corporate agribusiness.
Yeah, and of course the result is many family farmers went out of business, not just in the U.S. but in Canada and really anywhere that the global industrial agriculture model was adopted, Japan, Korea, you name it.
And the one exception that I'm aware of is France, which at the time was heavily criticized for subsidizing family farms, and yet now in retrospect appears to have been a sort of a collective thought leader in anticipation of the new trends.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I matured, my career matured during the wholesale industrialization, globalization of agriculture and our food system. And
what was that like? What was that like being not necessarily a lone voice, but certainly a voice surrounded by a bit of a sea of movement away from what you were saying? What was that experience like for you?
Well, early in my career, I didn't see it, Warren, honestly. I mean, we were taught that these technologies were about feeding the world. And that was the ethos in agriculture. We are going to feed the world.
The Green Revolution.
The Green Revolution. And there was little evidence at that time that these technologies, synthetic fertilizers, synthetic pesticides, were as damaging as we now know they are. And so it was relatively easy to buy into it and to advance it. Really, what got me most interested in this concept of sustainability or motivated me was the destruction of family farms. And because I saw it, I witnessed it.
Did you talk to farmers?
I've lived and worked in farming communities my entire career. But in the 80s, my wife and I lived and worked on a family farm in Missouri as we were both in graduate school. And that farm failed in the market adjustment of the 80s. And this couple, elderly couple, who were excellent farmers, loved what they did, lost their farm. And we helped them sort through everything, sell off the livestock, line everything up for auction, and that's what they did, and they moved to Minneapolis.
How did that impact you personally? I mean, as a person, you're watching these people you care for, who care for the same values you do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as a young adult studying agriculture, I certainly fell in love. Literally born it with plants and plant growth and development, and in particular, deciduous fruit trees. I just love them. but the other thing that really attracted me was the people who grew them, who grew our food, thoughtful, calm, people who cared for their farms and knew that the productivity of their farm was linked in their stewardship of the land. And they also knew the vitality of the community that they lived in was linked to their stewardship of that community. So what I really came to appreciate was the agrarian values that the people that taught me and that I worked with as a young professional exhibited. And I saw all that go away.
I'm just destroyed. Imagining I would speculate that you kept in touch with that elderly couple for some time afterwards, because it seems to me you would have been bonded with them at multiple levels. Their values, just the kind of people they were, the kind of way they approached the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly enough, some, yes, but not enough. Mm-hmm. And for all of these decades since, my spouse and I have lamented that we didn't do a better job. But, you know, we're like everybody else. We get caught up in this world. And yeah. it's a breakneck speed world anymore.
So as this was happening in the academic world, there was also this kind of struggle between sort of the corporate version of agriculture and the hands-on direct version of relating to the land. How did that play into your decision to move north? How did that bring you?
Well, yeah. So, I witnessed this transition, and then in the Washington tree fruit industry, When I first moved there and began working in the industry, in 1984, the industry was dominated by small family farms. The same as
Missouri.
The Okanagan, and in fact, you could make a living off of growing 10 acres of golden delicious apples, and over the 24 years that I lived and worked there, those family farms went to the wayside. Mm. Packing houses started consolidating. The selling desks started consolidating. And the margins that apple producers were operating under started shrinking. And the response was not to change the system, but to go with it. The challenge became get bigger or get out. Mm. And so you started seeing the small family farms get gobbled up by the bigger farms, and economies of scale shifted from 10 acres, 20 acres, 50 acres to thousands of acres. That became the scale. I remember my conviction was sealed when the last couple state conferences, apple fruit production conferences that are held every year in Washington, attract everybody from the industry, 2,000 apple growers and packers and shippers. The focus of the annual conference was all about how do we serve Walmart.
Hmm.
It became, well, if Walmart says jump, then the question becomes how high. And that spelled the demise of the kind of industry that I wanted to work for.
Now, you were one person in this crowd of 2,000 who didn't jump.
Yeah.
When they said, Walmart wants this, you said, I'm not interested. Did your professional colleagues and the people you're working with and the students you're working with, what did they think about you at that point? Obviously it challenged the relationship you had with that world of burgeoning industrial agriculture.
Yeah. Well, good question. I don't know that I absolutely know, but I know that I absolutely don't know.
But you have an idea.
Yeah. My thinking was not consistent with mainstream thinking in academia or in the industry, and it was at odds. The response was not positive. No.
And it was a response that was not positive to a degree that led you at that point to seriously consider crossing the border to the country to the north on a more sustained basis, a sustainable movement in your career. What was that like? Did you pack up just like one of these programs where the whole family puts all its furniture in a truck and crosses the border? I'm sure it was a little more organized than that.
A little more, but fairly close. Honestly, it took us a long time to find a position to move to Canada, and it was fairly dicey for a few years. There were some
moments.
I think it's fair to say that I was blackballed, in my position, I worked between the university, Washington State University, and the local college located in Wenatchee Valley College, and I think it's fair to say that I was actively drummed out of the Corps, found that the working environment was very hostile, and that it was personally and professionally in my family's best interest to get out of Dodge, as they say.
And come to the larger space, both intellectually perhaps and physically north of Dodge. Now, your initial link to Canada was a two-year grant to work at Kwantlen Polytechnic University and with a couple of colleagues. How did that arise? That was an important step.
Yeah, well, it was just quite serendipitous. So I just sent out a letter to KPU, to the Dean of Science, and I said, here are my qualifications. I know that there's major agriculture in Kwantlen's district, and I am looking to move to Canada and pursue my academic career. And the dean forwarded my letter to Deborah Henderson, who was the director of the Institute for Sustainable Horticulture at KPU. And it just so happened that she was working with the British Columbia Nursery Landscape Association on the implementation of an integrated pest management certification program for the nursery landscape sector to foster reduced use of glyphosate primarily, but pesticides in general, that which you referred to early in the show. And so she hired me.
I think that's the kind of listeners will know that I use the word serendipity all the time on this show because it's a guiding principle for human lives. Remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Kent Mullenix, who's the director of the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. So the grant you were working on with was a breath of fresh air, it would seem to me, because it was at least fundamentally oriented towards sustainability. But things didn't work out, as I understand, exactly as you and your colleagues who were working on it had hoped. How did it end?
Yeah, it failed. Bottom line, the director of the BC LNA was quite sincere. Her name was Jane Stock. She's no longer with us.
And LNA.
Yeah, BC Nursery Landscape Association. Okay, she was right. The executive director. She was quite sincere. She read the writing on the wall that the industry needed to quit using glyphosates and needed to embrace biologically based pest management, reduce its dependence on pesticides. And that's what she wanted to do incrementally through this certification program. But the industry didn't buy into it. And so we developed it over 2 years, attempted to implement it, and it just did not fly.
This was a time when IPM, Integrated Pest Management, was a system that had originally been developed to reduce pesticide use, but was being steadily co-opted by industry as a cover for maintaining, at the very least, if not increasing, pesticide use. That was a few years before the committee that we talked about at the beginning of the show actually kiboshed the whole idea of even eliminating cosmetic pesticides just used for beautification growing. So after that project kind of fell by the wayside, as you would say, what happened to get you? How did the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems spring out of the ashes like Phoenix to become a really living and valid entry into the growing of food?
Yeah. So this period of time is when Kwantlen University College was making its bid to become Kwantlen Polytechnic University. One of the things that the institution needed to demonstrate was that it had research capacity. So by fiat, again, absolute serendipity, I had no idea that this would occur. In fact, the grant had run out and I was worried about where my next paycheck was going to come from. The president gave me a full-time job as a researcher. And then I was authorized to establish the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems in 2009.
So that must have been a bit of a watershed moment, not only, for you, of course. I mean, you knew where the next paycheck was coming from, thank heavens. Mm-hmm. But also in terms of the process that you were engaged in, which was advocating for and promoting a changeover from the industrial corporate system of growing food to the system that we all are learning is the only way for us to fly. That must have been, when the head of the university tells you you have a green light to go ahead, that must have been a very constructive moment in your own awareness of things.
Well, absolutely, Warren. It was amazing. I'll tell you, when my family and I came to the Lower Mainland on sabbatical in 97, I had, at that time, I'd become very interested in exploring what the antithesis of globalization in agriculture and our food system would be, which is regionalization. And actually is what I would call re-regionalization, because I grew up in regional food systems. All of us of our age did. That was the way the economy was configured. So when I saw the Lower Mainland with all of this agriculture land surrounding all of this major market, I said to myself, what better laboratory for advancing a regional food system could you ask for? And so when I was afforded the opportunity to establish this research unit and research and extension unit, the Institute, the focus immediately was on advancing bioregional food systems.
Did the university, the director, but also the university and the academic world that you were immersed in at this point, did it understand that? Did you had to kind of go off to a corner quietly and set this up while nobody was looking, sort of thing?
Yeah, well, that's a super good question. And the answer is no, of course not, because it was novel, but they weren't antagonistic.
Yeah, so at least allowing it was better than actively opposing it.
Absolutely. And in fact, I just have to say it. Kwantlen Polytechnic University, this little university, has provided absolutely the best environment that I've ever worked in. And enabled me to do work that I just don't think I could have done elsewhere. And it's because KPU is not entrenched. And that's really the secret to all of this. We've got to get out of our trenches and our dogmatic ways of thinking around agriculture and food. And one of the things that I've realized in my work is that, well, when I first was at university and I became attracted to academia, for a profession, I was under the impression that the university was about innovation and change and social improvement. and I've come to learn that substantially it's about maintaining the status quo and reinforcing the status quo. And so to work for a university that did not resist new thinking and squash it, but allow it to happen was like a breath of fresh air.
It sounds like it afforded you an opportunity to be part of the transformative process that we're now immersed in today. I want to switch gears a little bit because we've got you safely home in the Institute, but I think listeners would be interested to know that your background wasn't in your family background was not in the world of food. Your background was a military one, not personally, but your father was actually a colonel in the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force.
That's correct.
And your initial, when you left high school and went into a sort of a college venture, it was a time when you were really trying to figure out what you wanted to do. And just describe that kind of process, because maybe that prepared you for the sort of things that you're doing now. You have to make changes in midstream.
Yeah, could be. It is true. I was born and raised in a military family. My father was a soldier through and through. In fact, he we're a Missouri family. Both my parents are Missourians. So by default, I'm a Missourian too. But my dad was in uniform from the time he was 12. He went to Missouri Military Academy and then joined the Army and end of World War II, was in the Army Air Corps, went to the University of Missouri where he did ROTC, and then he became an officer in the Air Force. So my family was a military family through and through. I was talking to my son about that last night, in fact. And we moved around a lot. So, for example, I lived for a couple years in Lincoln, Nebraska. We moved to Bangkok, Thailand for 2 years, and then from there to Montgomery, Alabama, where I went the last year of middle school and high school, and then off to the University of Missouri.
In retrospect, looking back at this mobile lifestyle, do you sense how that's played into things that are working in your life now? I mean, obviously, it meant you could transfer geographically without going through a lot of pain and turmoil, which somebody who'd stayed in the same place for
Yeah. Well, I learned how to move and be respectful. And I mean, I learned early in life, Warren, that you don't move someplace and start passing judgment and say, well, you know, we did it better where I come from, because people are not receptive to that sort of thing.
And I would also add, it makes you unable to perceive what they have to offer that is special and wonderful.
Exactly. And so, yeah, moving around, experiencing different cultures, both within the U.S. and abroad, really helps one be more receptive and more accepting. And I think the important thing, and this has been reinforced more in my professional life, is that we need to understand that there are multiple realities, that people perceive the world in very diverse ways. And we need to be respectful of that and accepting of that. And in fact, try to learn from it, because they're not wrong.
And we're not right exclusively.
And we're not necessarily right.
But maybe
exactly.
All of us have a little wrong and a little right embedded in.
Over 30 years, no, maybe 25 years ago, I put together and taught my first sustainable agriculture class. And I started the class with a colleague, an anthropologist. And the beginning of the class was all about worldviews. Because I needed these agriculture students to know that they didn't have a monopoly on good thinking, that their reality was not the only reality. And this anthropologist was just a tremendous person and able to convey this concept so skillfully. Now,
when you were, interestingly, you're saying this because when you started out at university, you weren't sure what you wanted to do.
No.
And you tried a little business courses and some anthropology as well.
But
then you told me that the thing that really got you focused was that you thought, well, you know, I like being out in the garden. I really like being there. And that was when the light bulb went off.
That's what you were asking. So yeah, I was not a good student. I think moving around in the military, I wasn't a good student, and I really barely qualified to get into university. And I spent a couple of years goofing off. It was the 70s.
There we are. We have the excuse that we all need.
But really it was that I wasn't motivated. I entered university. My dad said study business. So, you know, I did, and it did not speak to me. And then I moved into journalism for a semester. That didn't speak to me. Anthropology intrigued me, but it didn't captivate me. And like in all universities, at the end of your second year, or what we call sophomore year in the U.S., you have to declare a major. And nothing had captured my interest, and I knew I needed to.
I just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Dr. Kent Mullenix, who's the director of the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems, located at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Well, after those initial unfocused and distracted years at university, you certainly, once you had found something that you really cared about, you took off, first with a bachelor's degree in agriculture, focused on fruit and vegetable production, not just flowers. Then a master's in horticulture, which was focused around pomology, the growing of fruit trees. And then a PhD, which was sort of like the capstone on that process, a PhD in agriculture education, meaning that you were clearly orienting yourself to share what you cared about and what you had learned with others. I mean, as I was sort of working my way through this trajectory that you were on, it seemed to me that it became clearer and clearer as time went by for you. It became clearer and clearer what you really wanted to do, which was not only study it, but also share it, like bring it to the attention of others.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And of course, isn't this the journey that we're all on? What we end up doing later in life is not necessarily what we envisioned early in life.
Yes, you spontaneously use the word serendipity twice, for which you get two bonus points.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, it is true. So when I had to think about what it was I wanted to study, well, first I had to ask myself, do you even belong here? Mm. And the answer in my soul searching was yes. And then it was, okay, well, what is it you want to be here for? And I asked myself, what have you ever done that you really, in your military upbringing of moving all around and having no roots, what is it you've ever done that you really just enjoyed, brought you pleasure? And you won't believe it, the only thing I could think of was growing a garden when I was a kid in Denver, when we lived in Denver for a couple years. And I said, that's it. I'm going to go study horticulture. But the fortunate part was, Warren, and something that I think about often today, was that I got to study with all these thoughtful professors and who really cared about agriculture and community. And they were not focused on industrialization. They were focused on, I don't actually know what they were focused on, but they were all post-World War II professors. They'd all been to war. And I think they brought a very unique perspective to their work. And they were really an inspiration. And one in particular, a professor named Aubrey Hibbard, who was the state who taught pomology, fruit production, and other things, took me under his wings, and he I can only assume saw potential that I probably did. Well, I know I didn't even see in myself. and he taught me and ultimately hired me after I graduated to be his research specialist.
The trajectory that you're on, as so many people who've been on this show, is to find what touches their heart, or touches, if you want to call it, their soul, something that really speaks to them in a profound way. And as George Burns once said, the famous stand-up comedian said, when he was in his 90s and he was at a service club doing a presentation, and he said, "This world is absurd. This world is completely absurd. Here I am, an old guy in my 90s, standing up and telling jokes to a bunch of people, and they pay me to do it." Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't pay you to tell jokes. They have been paying you now to bring a concept forward that is very much in tune with the way the world is going everywhere, and that is the creation of sustainable food systems. The work of the Institute, is very broad-based. And to be honest, I don't think we're going to be able to get it all down today. And I'd like to ask you, if I could, to have you come back at some point, and we can go into much more detail about what the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems is up to, because it covers a broad range of activities. But maybe today we can talk a little bit about the mission, because the mission is so clear and so, as far as I would see it, progressive. For the first point in your mission statement, it says, "We engage in multidisciplinary applied research and extension." Now, I want to just focus on the word extension. Mm-hmm. For decades, there was a relationship between farmers and academics where they'd go out and stand in the field, and they would talk about what each was doing, and they would share their perspectives, and they'd work out some kind of relationship between each of their perspectives. Why don't you talk about extension and your feeling about that aspect of what you do?
Well, I think it's extremely important and valuable, and because it's effective, it's a very effective way to advance a sector and any sector. It's a very important way to advance community development. And it is, in fact, probably the most successful education approach that's ever been conceived. It is what enabled the industrialization of agriculture. It's also what's going to enable the deindustrialization of agriculture. This relationship between academics who are charged with creating new knowledge and sharing that new knowledge with the people who are going to use it and working with them to adopt it and advance their sector is a powerful, powerful tool.
Mm. Yes, it is. And the sector that is being advanced is the sector in which regional, and this is part of that first mission statement, cultivating sustainable regional food systems. Now, you mentioned about when you first arrived, seeing the farms around Richmond, the farmland around Richmond. But regional food systems are kind of the antidote to the globalization project, which we'll call it a project because it isn't fixed in stone. Why don't you talk about that antidote and how powerful it can be?
Yeah. Well, yes, the debate rages of whether our agriculture and food system should be focused globally, or whether it should be focused locally. So scale and focus are really the epicenter of the big debate on the future of our food system. And I advocate local, like town level local or municipality level local, is not big enough to build food systems. It is important, but not big enough. I believe that the scale that is appropriate for building robust food systems that are the antithesis of the transnational system is the bioregion.
Mm.
And so it provides enough size to support the production, post-production, distribution in a viable economic system. And so we've been working to advance the concept and implementation of bioregional food systems in British Columbia.
And the principle there, which I think is quite striking, is that the unifying factor is that it's a bioregion. In other words, it's a already unified natural system that has that shares characteristics, so that the movement of food within the region can be coordinated, because multiple producers will be producing very similar things in that bioregion. An interesting concept that was very much part of indigenous life in this part of the world before European settlers arrived. There was an Ulican trail that went to the coast, and interior Salish would go and get Ulican oil and Ulicans themselves and bring them back and take out their specialty goods and products and trade them in a wonderful linkage that is so basic to human survival.
Yep.
Maybe we can close with a little bit of a discussion of the research activity. There's a special unit within the Institute that is focused on, well, the unit, I suppose the Institute itself is sort of a single unit for this, research and extension activity, looking at fostering more, as you say, the creation of more knowledge, or the discovery of more knowledge. I like to think of it as discovery, because it was already there. We just humans didn't know it.
True.
And you focus on BC, but you've extended this approach outside the province as well. Why don't you talk about that extension?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll say this with the greatest humility. We have emerged, because of the skills and talents of this diverse team, as a really effective research and extension unit. And the work that we're doing, advancing bioregional food systems in all of its dimensions, from modeling the potentials to looking at policy and strategies to advance them, has gained global attention. And the Institute is seen as a Canadian leader in the advancement of sustainable regional food systems, and which is a real source of pride and gratification to me. But I'm very pleased that the concept of I didn't invent the concept of re-regionalization of food systems, of course. But I'm very pleased that our work to advance the re-regionalization of food systems is seen as valuable.
I'd like to close with a couple of quotes from John Eichard. John Eichard is an agricultural economist, but somebody who also is driven by values, is driven by a sense of progression away from the impersonality of corporate agriculture towards the intimacy, if you like, of family farms and small-scale agriculture. And he said, and you actually quoted him in an interview we were doing some time ago last year with the Green Technology Education Center. He said, hope doesn't lie in your confidence that you're going to prevail. Hope lies in the knowledge that what you're doing is the right thing to do. And that's the sense I get of what you just said now, that feeling that you're doing something that is the right thing, it's contagious. It spreads, you know, kind of like a wildfire. People say, yes, that's what I want to do. And I get the sense that that's been a central theme for you.
It is. As I've shared with you, John Eichard is if there's any individual that I would say influenced my thinking, it would be John.
He's the guy. Well, I'm equally proud to say that we had him on Food Conversations last year, and he was just like you. He was an expansive thinker who acts locally, but thinks on beyond the globe. I mean, into the sort of the heart of the matter.
His willingness to support people in this endeavor is just nothing short of inspiring.
Yeah, he is a wonderful person.
But it is true. I just have to say it is thinking about what's the right thing to do. What's the right way to live?
That's right.
That's what really motivates me.
Well, it's abundantly clear to our listeners today that you have followed that path, and that it's become clear not only to you but to many other people around the world, not just in British Columbia, not just in North America, but around the world. And I am personally, and I'm sure our listeners are delighted to have spent some time with you and hear your story. And I'd very much like to have you back again to explore all the work that the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems is doing, because I think it will be equally enlightening and very much hands-on and down-to-earth as well. Thank you very much for being with us today, Kent. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, the pleasure has been mine, Warren, and I would love to spend more time with you and talk about the work of the Institute and talk far less about me.
There we are. It'll be a delight. Something to look forward to. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.